Corkscrew Wine Emporium in Urbana. This Friday, July 8th from 6 to 9 p.m., the Corkscrew will be hosting a Spanish and Portuguese wine party to benefit the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. Then on Saturday evening, local singer-songwriter Kate Hathaway will be playing from 8 to 10 p.m. Information at 337-7704 or at thecorkscrew.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, WILL Urbana, and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we'll look back at the 1965 murder of civil rights worker Viola Liuzzo and its relevance for us today. Viola Liuzzo, forgive me, was killed while driving with a young black colleague after the Alabama Voting Rights March. She was a 39-year-old housewife and mother from Detroit. After the demonstration, she drove a carload of passengers, black and white, out of Montgomery. One on the way to the airport, the others were on their way to Selma. After their destinations were reached, one activist, Leroy Moten, a transportation officer, remained in the car. Liuzzo was giving him a lift back to Montgomery, where he would continue his work picking up people and moving cars. But on the road back to Montgomery, a Chevrolet Impala began following them. It pulled up beside them. 14 shots were fired into the car. Moten survived, but Liuzzo was dead. One day later, President Johnson told the nation that four men had been arrested. One of the men said to have been arrested was Gary Thomas Rowe, Jr. In reality, he had not been arrested. He was present at the shooting, but he was an undercover FBI informant. He had been recruited by the FBI in 1960 to join the Klan Clavern based in Birmingham. Our guest this afternoon is historian Gary May. He is the author of The Informant, The FBI, The Ku Klux Klan, and The Murder of Viola Liuzzo. Gary May says the murder is one of the most important but overlooked racial murders of the 1960s. He says it shocked America and galvanized the civil rights movement, contributing to the enactment of one of the most important pieces of legislation in American history, the Voting Rights Act of 1965. May also says this at the opening of his book, The Informant, but what perhaps gives the Liuzzo case its historical importance and even contemporary relevance is the light it sheds on the FBI's secret informant system, which continues to this day. Listeners, you can join the discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Gary May is professor of history and director of the Master of Arts in Liberal Studies program at the University of Delaware. His book, The Informant, is published by Yale. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor May, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me, Celeste.
Sure. What led you to research and write about this murder and Gary Thomas Rowe, Jr.?
Well, when I was finishing my last book, which also dealt in part with the role of the FBI in American life in the 1950s, I was noticing that a number of what might be called cold cases were being reopened, the case of Medgar Evers, the case of the murders of the young women in Alabama who were blown apart. And I decided that for my next book, I would look into one of these cases, and I discovered that the Liuzzo case really had not been done by a historian, had not received the attention that I thought it deserved. So like most historians, I set out to see what documents would be available, and I filed Freedom of Information Act requests with the FBI and was able to get access to the Liuzzo family lawyers' records, which were a wonderfully rich source for me. I spoke to members of the Liuzzo family. And as I was doing this, I discovered that the important story here was about Gary Thomas Rowe, the informant, and that became the main focus of the book.
Yeah. What are your thoughts, by the way, about the recent trials we've seen that have been the result of reopening murder cases from the 1960s?
They're fascinating. I mean, for a historian, it's extraordinary. William Faulkner once said that the past isn't dead. It isn't even past. What happened 30, 40, even 50 years ago in the South is still very much with us. On the one hand, I feel tremendous satisfaction that some justice is finally being achieved. But on the other hand, the story is much larger than the individuals who have been finally brought to justice. In other words, in the case of the three civil rights workers who were murdered in Mississippi in 1964, and now Edgar Ray Killen finally being tried and then convicted and receiving a very stiff prison sentence, it suggests that these are the primary actors in the story. And while that may be true, there are a number of other people involved as well. I mean, in Neshoba, Mississippi, it was well known who was involved in this crime, and there's still a number of others who the grand jury decided not to indict, and it's not clear whether there will ever be indicted. So that in so many of these towns, in Neshoba, in the case of the three civil rights workers, in Money, Mississippi, where Emmett Till was killed, you have whole towns that are sort of complicit in these crimes, people who have information about others who might have been involved, afraid to come forward even 50 years after the event. So I have kind of mixed feelings about, these recent events.
Yeah. If this case could be reopened, how do you think it would turn out?
Well, I don't think it's possible to reopen it legally. The Klansmen involved, including Gary Thomas Rowe, are dead. My hope is, and what I tried to do with the book, was to reopen the case intellectually, because it seemed to me that what was really important about the story of Gary Thomas Rowe, and this became really clear to me after 9/11 and President Bush's call to increase our human intelligence, which meant recruiting informants to get them into terrorist groups. It seemed to me that Rowe's experience inside the Klan as an FBI informant, had lessons for us today.
Mm, definitely. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian Gary May. Gary, we have a listener waiting to talk with us on a cell phone, so let's go and talk to this individual. Line one, good afternoon.
Yeah, hi, I'm on a cell phone, as you said. I always thought it was Violet Liuzzo. Is that the same person you're speaking about?
No, it's Viola Liuzzo was her name. Yes.
Was her name? Oh, I always thought it was Violet. Well, I think she deserves recognition because I remember that very much when it happened and always thought that not much was said about her. Didn't she have a family, too? She just did it because she was idealistic?
Yes, she had five children, the youngest of whom was 6 years old, and she made sure their children were cared for, and when Martin Luther King invited Americans to come down and join the Voting Rights March in March of 1965, she was determined to go, and she went.
Yeah, it's impressive. I mean, that was such a time when we either marched or went down south. I mean, it was just an incredible time.
Well, she was very courageous, and you're quite right that she has not received the recognition that she deserves. I mean, after all, she is the only white woman to have lost her life in the civil rights movement. And by going down there, she challenged all sorts of contemporary thinking, if you will, a woman participating in the civil rights movement, taking part in events that were quite dangerous. In fact, as I discuss in the book, following her death, the Ladies' Home Journal commissioned a national poll asking readers whether they thought a woman should ever, a mother should ever risk her life in any kind of political cause. And the results were about 90% of those who were polled indicated that no, that a woman should never do such a thing. And what was interesting about this was that there was another person who lost their life prior to the Voting Rights March, a Unitarian minister named James Reeb. And he went down, and no one ever asked the same kinds of questions that they asked following Liuzzo's death. Had he made sure that his children were taken care of? And, you know, he should never have gone because it was too risky. So there was some degree of you know, some sexism here, which Liuzzo challenged.
Yeah, of course, a lot of women went down and were beaten up in those civil rights marches.
Yes.
And confronted dogs and brutal sheriffs and cops. I mean, just the drama of the photographs coming through, which
That's
really
right.
heightened the response and caused a lot of change in all of those laws. Well, I'm glad you've written it. And I will try to get that book. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for the call. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Of the two central figures here, Roe and Liuzzo, you say they've been seen as polar opposites, but you say they shared, actually, a number of common experiences.
Yes. Although Liuzzo was born in rural Pennsylvania, she actually grew up in the South, in Georgia and Tennessee, and always considered herself a Southerner. And after her death, some accused her of being the sort of classic outside agitator, a Northern liberal who came down to the South to tell Southerners how to live their lives, when in fact she considered herself a Southerner. And when she had children of her own, she would return to the South to show them the places where she lived. And, of course, Roe was born in Savannah, Georgia, and lived for most of his life in Birmingham. Both of them had been married multiple times. Both had very little formal education. But most importantly, both of them were sort of seeking a cause greater than themselves. And for Liuzzo, it became ultimately the civil rights movement. And for Gary Thomas Roe, who all of his life, his greatest dream was to become a policeman. And unfortunately, he had never graduated high school, so he was unable to achieve that status. In fact, he tried to become a county sheriff in Alabama and falsified his application, claiming that he was a high school graduate. They caught him, and they rejected him. He also applied to the Birmingham police force, but they, too, denied him because of his lack of education. Yet he remained close to the police, a kind of cop wannabe, rode in squad cars, hung out with cops at bars, partied with them. And then the FBI comes to him and believes that he would be a perfect person to infiltrate the Klan because he was young, he was 26 years old, he was physically tough. He knew Klansmen, although at that point in 1960, he was not a member of the Klan. He knew law enforcement people. And when the agent appeared at his home and raised the question of whether he would go inside the Klan for them, it was the greatest moment of his life. All he had aspired to was to become a police officer. And now he was becoming a undercover agent, as he described it, inside the Klan for the FBI, a kind of redneck James Bond. So that, too, you know, sort of fulfilled all of his dreams.
Yeah. Before the FBI came calling, the Klan was interested in him as well.
Yes. Roe was quite a character in Birmingham. He was a bouncer at a bar. He was a man who used his fists, loved a good brawl, considered his fists deadly weapons. As I say, about 6 feet tall, stocky, very strong, aggressive, and to the Klan, he seemed someone who would make an ideal Klansman.
Hmm. You know, when I started reading The Informant, I thought of Jack Ruby.
Well, I don't really see too much of a comparison there. Ruby, after all, had underworld connections. Physically, maybe there was some resemblance, stocky, but I really don't see that comparison.
Yeah. Well, they look a little bit alike, and I thought of Jack Ruby in terms of sort of the outlaw who wanted to be an insider.
Mm. Yeah, could be.
Yeah. Recruiting informers is an art, you say. How is it done?
Well, in this case, the FBI ran a sort of very quick investigation of Roe, quite a sloppy one, in fact, overlooking a number of things that might have raised doubt in their mind about Roe's reliability. In 1960, when they were considering him, they overlooked the fact that he'd been married before, that he had sort of dumped his wife and a child whom he never had any contact with, a very sort of checkered career, sort of moving from one job to another. He was an ambulance driver for a while, and then he was fired from that job because of allowing friends to ride in the ambulance with him. They did some investigation, and then they approached him and discussed the possibility of going inside the Klan. And then they said, well, you know, think about it, and we'll get back to you in a couple of days. So they kind of, you know, sort of, it rather like a seduction. And ultimately, they achieved what they wanted, although they really didn't have to work very hard at it because, as I say, this fulfilled all of Roe's dreams, and there was never any question whether or not he would do what they wanted.
Hmm. Why did the FBI want in? What was on their agenda?
Well, once the civil rights movement began to become extremely active in the South, particularly in the early 1960s, you have the first events, I guess, that were the sit-in movements that began in Nashville and then went throughout the South. The Klan began to respond and to become energized. And J. Edgar Hoover had always despised the Klan, seeing them as a subversive group. And, of course, later he came to see the civil rights movement in the same way and decided that he would infiltrate the Klan as he had done with the American Communist Party in the 1950s. That was kind of the model he used, picking outsiders to go inside first the Communist Party in the 50s and now the Klan in the 1960s.
Hmm. How were informants prepared to go inside, to become informants?
Well, first, the FBI explained to them that they were not FBI agents, that they were, in a sense, contract labor, that they would receive payment for information that they gave to the FBI. But they should understand that they should not be involved in violence. They should not plan violence. They should not participate in violence. That if they broke the law, they could be arrested by the FBI, just like a common lawbreaker would be. But they also said to them, look, we understand that you may find yourself in the middle of a riot and that you're just not going to be able to stand by and do nothing. So that it's okay if you've got to throw a punch. But the implication really was you can do much more than that if you have to. That there were two things that were important. One was to protect your cover, to protect, you know, your identity. Don't ever do anything that would reveal that you might not be an enthusiastic Klansman, in fact, that you might be an undercover informant. And a second, you know, try to do nothing that would embarrass the Bureau and get us that information. That was what was important. Do anything that you had to do to get us the information.
Hmm. He was recruited in April 1960, and you say by the following April, over the course of a year, the leash the FBI had tethered to him disappeared. How did the FBI lose control?
Well, that was what was so interesting about the informant system. The FBI could control an informant or believe they could control an informant. They would have contact with him sometimes on a daily basis. But the informant, as in Roe's case, came to control the FBI. They could really do just about anything they wanted to do, up and perhaps even including a murder, if so long as they got the information. And for the informant to rise up within the Klan group, or clavern as they were called, they had to be involved increasingly in violence. And the FBI saw this not as a thing that to be worried about, Roe's involvement in violent activities such as the attack on the Freedom Riders in 1961, which we can talk about. This wasn't a bad thing. In fact, it was a good thing, because it encouraged the Klan to believe that Roe was an authentic Klansman, and it enabled him to rise up within the clavern into more influential positions where he could get even more important information.
Mm. At the same time, it makes the agency complicit.
It does. Absolutely. That is the troubling, sometimes even dangerous thing about running informants.
Is that danger, is that risk there today?
Oh, absolutely. Following Liuzzo's murder, and actually Roe testified in the 1970s before the Church Committee, which was investigating the excesses of the FBI and the CIA in the 1960s, you know, he revealed everything that he had done. The FBI set out to tighten its regulations regarding informants, and they've done that, they say, over the years. But those regulations, as even some agents admitted to me privately and off the record, those regulations are ignored. It's impossible to run an informant under any kind of control, any kind of regulations. You never know what the informant is going to face, what kind of situation he or she is going to be confronted with. And again, sometimes the agents didn't want to know everything that the informant had to do.
Hmm. Well, what are the stakes then in the search for terrorists and terrorist threats today?
Well, I think the problem lies particularly when you take an outsider and you try to put them inside a Klan group. Because as Roe's case illustrated, when an outsider goes in, they are immediately under suspicion that they might be an informant. And in fact, Roe was challenged several times by the Klansmen, accused of being an FBI informant. And Roe had an amazing ability to either talk or fight his way out of these moments when he was challenged. And again, an outsider, in order to prove himself, has got to participate in violent activities. So if today the FBI or the CIA recruited an outsider and put him inside, say, an al-Qaeda group, this person has got to commit horrendous acts, and the CIA would be complicit.
Hmm. Do you oppose the use of informants or only the use of outsiders as informants?
I think the most trouble is with outside informants. And in fact, again, history here is instructive. In the 1960s, the FBI was able to crack the Mississippi burning case, the murder of the three civil rights workers in 1964, not by placing informants inside the Klan, but by buying information from existing Klansmen inside the Klan. They paid Klansmen around $30,000 for information about who had been involved in the killing of the three, where their bodies were buried, that sort of thing. So I think that, now I'm not opposed to the total use of informants. I think it's more useful when they're able to turn an informant who's, rather turn a, you know, a terrorist, whether it be a Klansman or an al-Qaeda terrorist, who's already inside the group, and get information that way.
Hmm. How does the Bureau feel about Roe in hindsight today?
Well, of course, they don't really say anything about him. Initially, he was looked upon, at least publicly, as something of a hero. After all, if he had not reported the murder to his FBI handler, it's unlikely that the others would ever have been identified. Roe testified in local court when the Klansmen were being tried. And, of course, the Klansmen were acquitted, found not guilty by, you know, sort of segregated racist juries. And Roe was seen in part and by the Liuzzo family as something of a hero. Of course, much of what Roe had done, the attack on the Freedom Riders in 1961, his possible involvement in the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church, all of that was hidden. It was Roe himself who finally went public. After Liuzzo's murder and after Roe testified, and eventually the Klansmen were found guilty of having violated Liuzzo's civil rights and sent to prison for 10 years, Roe's connection with the FBI was severed. He received a reward of $10,000. He was given a new name, a new identity, and a job as a deputy U.S. Marshal in San Diego. Roe could change his name, but he couldn't change his character. He remained a hellraiser and got into fights in bars, and the U.S. Marshal Service finally fired him after about a year. We're talking about 1968, 69 at this point. Roe found it difficult finding a new job without the FBI's protection and assistance. He finally got angry at the FBI for what he considered their broken promises and went before the church committee and revealed all these things that he had been involved in. And the FBI now changed their public view of him, that Roe was now a bad guy and he was a, in part, they confirmed some of the things that he had been involved in, but kept others a secret and just denied that he had been as bad as Roe claimed he had been.
Yeah. There was another trial then when the Liuzzo family filed suit against the FBI.
That's right. Once Roe went public and revealed everything that he had done, the Liuzzo family was shocked. I mean, they went through a number of terrible experiences. One, of course, was the death of the children's mother. And then during the Klansmen's trials, they attempted to smear Liuzzo, claiming that she'd only come south to sleep with black men, that she'd been a drug addict and had a jail record, and all of these things were really untrue. And then, with Roe giving them all this information, questions came into their mind. Well, if he was an FBI informant, why didn't he prevent the murder of their mother? And so they filed a wrongful death lawsuit against the FBI, and it finally came to adjudication in the 1980s. Because it was a wrongful death lawsuit, there was no formal trial with a jury. The case was heard by a Michigan judge, and eventually the Michigan judge ruled against them, did not feel that the FBI was really legally culpable in their case.
Hmm. What do you think of that ruling?
I don't think it was actually a correct one. Legal adjudication is extremely tricky and difficult. In order to prove the FBI culpable, Liuzzo's attorneys had to prove, beyond a shadow of a doubt or beyond a reasonable doubt, that either Roe himself had shot and killed Liuzzo, or that his presence in the car had contributed in a major way to the Klansmen attacking Liuzzo. Now, most of the evidence that I found indicated that Roe probably did not fire the fatal shot, and the judge earlier found reached that same conclusion. But I don't think the judge appreciated, because he really didn't, in part, he didn't have as much information as a historian would later have, having access to all of the records. But my view is that Roe being in the car, and here's again something that's interesting and also dangerous about the use of informants. The FBI protected Roe when he was an informant inside the Klan. They never touched him. They never, when he attacked the Freedom Riders in 1961, again, they didn't see that as negative. They thought it was positive. So a protective veil covered Roe's activities as an informant, but it also covered the Klansmen he was most friendly with, because they feared that if they went after any of the Klansmen who were close to Roe, it might eventually lead to Roe, might identify him as an FBI informant, and that he would lose his any kind of usefulness to them. And my feeling is that the night that they chased after Liuzzo's car, as you described it, and fired the shots, I think the other Klansmen in the car realized that they could do that. They could get away with murder because there was a good chance that Roe was, in fact, an FBI informant, and therefore they were as much protected as Roe was.
Hmm. Well, as you've alluded to a little bit earlier, you believe that Roe was involved, probably involved, in the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing in Birmingham in 63 that killed four young girls.
Yes.
What evidence links Roe to that crime, and was the FBI aware of that?
Well, almost all of Roe's Klan friends knew that a bomb was being planted in the church in the middle of the night. They apparently felt that the bomb was going to go off in the middle of the night when the church was vacant and no one would be killed. The Klansmen were not always the best bomb makers. It's inconceivable to me that if all of Roe's friends knew what was going on, that Roe himself would not know, because there were a number of bombings in Birmingham in the 1960s prior to the church bombing, and Roe was always the first one to report it to his FBI handler. And later, when the FBI officials were asked about this, when Roe was being investigated, actually, by the Justice Department in the 1970s, didn't you think it strange that Roe was the first one to report a bombing? Didn't you think that perhaps he might have been involved in planting and setting the bomb himself? And they would say, oh, no, he was just being a good citizen. So it's inconceivable to me that Roe did not know that a bomb was being put in the church in the middle of the night. And later, when the bomb went off the following morning and killed those four young women and injured so many other people, when the FBI went to Roe and said, who do you think might have been involved in this crime, Roe gave them the names of people who were remote from involvement in that crime. I mean, it was very clear who were the most likely suspects in that case. And Roe, for some reason, and I think the reason is, again, his connection to this crime, should have given them the names. There's no secret, there was one chief bomber who was later actually convicted for killing the young girls, convicted in the first trial in the 1970s. Bob Chambliss, who was known as Dynamite Bob, because that's what he did. He set bombs and blew up black homes and black churches, so much so in an area of Birmingham that area became known as Dynamite Hill. And Birmingham itself became known as Bombingham. Mm. Now, Dynamite Bob would have been the primary suspect for Roe to have told the FBI the following morning when the bomb went off. But he didn't name Bob Chambliss, and he didn't name Bobby Frank Cherry or Tommy Blanton, the two men who were eventually tried in the year 2001 and 2002 and found guilty. And it's awfully strange. Roe, who was so much involved in all of these events and knew all these men so intimately, why didn't he name those men? And it suggests to me an involvement. I don't think that Roe was among the group that actually planted the bomb, but I do feel strongly that he did have prior knowledge that the bomb was going to be put in the building, and he did not tell that to the FBI.
Hmm. In terms of value of information, what did he give the FBI? Did he ever help prevent violence?
There were a couple of occasions where Roe's information actually did prevent violence, and probably the most dramatic example of that was in 1962, Roe learned that the Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, who was perhaps you could call him the Martin Luther King of Birmingham, the man most active in the civil rights movement, was going to be assassinated by a group of Klansmen, including Roe. And Roe reported that to his FBI handler. Now, the FBI was in a difficult position there because it was a very small group of men who knew about this plot to assassinate Shuttlesworth. So they paused for a while. You know, they thought, well, if we prevent this assassination from occurring, we might blow Roe's cover. But on the other hand, you know, we don't really want Shuttlesworth to be assassinated. So in the end, they concluded, well, they've got to warn Reverend Shuttlesworth. They did warn him. They told him, do not go to this restaurant that you want to desegregate in Birmingham because there's an assassination plot, and Shuttlesworth did not go there that night, and in effect, Roe saved his life. So there was a case. I mean, that's the most dramatic case, a dramatic example of Roe's information being used by the FBI to prevent violence from happening. But we're talking about a career that lasted 5 years.
Right.
That included, as I say, attacks on the Freedom Riders, attacks on other civil rights workers, the possibility of being involved in the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, and maybe even, you know, being involved in the Veusa killing itself. So we've got, you know, that's the one most positive achievement of Roe as an FBI informant over a five-year career.
Hmm. Could the murder of Viola Liuzzo have been prevented?
I think it could have been, which was, one of the puzzling aspects of this story, because Roe prided himself as a man's man, as a macho guy. As I say, his fists are themselves lethal weapons. Why didn't he stop it? Roe himself said that he froze. He just could not act. And he felt, he was also afraid that he was armed, he had his own gun, that if he pulled his gun and told the Klansmen, you know, stop this, you're under arrest, I work for the FBI, he was afraid that the law enforcement people who might be called to come might themselves be Klansmen and would kill him. So it's fascinating that this man, as I say, who prided himself on being such a courageous person, at the supreme moment that he was tested, he failed that test.
Hmm. What became of Leroy Moton, the man who was in the car with Viola Liuzzo?
Well, amazingly, he had no injuries except for a dislocated shoulder. He was not struck by any of the bullets that were fired. He was able to get out of the car to make his way onto the highway where he met civil rights workers who finally got him back to Selma. He eventually moved from Alabama. He testified during the trial of the Klansmen in local court. I think today he's alive and well and living in Connecticut.
Hmm. Have you talked with him?
I didn't decide. I didn't. He's the one person I did not talk to. His memory in 1965 of the events was so poor. He claimed that he could not. It was dark when the attack occurred. He could not identify any of the men inside the car. He could not even identify the make of the car. And it seemed to me that if I spoke with him 40 years after the event, mm-hmm. that his memory would probably not have improved very much. And I do know other scholars who have talked with him, and they reported to me that, you know, that his memory is not any better than it was 40 years ago.
Yeah. He sprang to mind at this point in the interview because you were talking about the possibility of law enforcement authorities being members of the Klan. And here was this man who is now on foot fleeing for his life, and he's faced with the same situation.
That's right. That's right. He was Liuzzo's death occurred in Lowndes County, Alabama, known as Bloody Lowndes, for its especially brutal treatment of blacks. There was a saying that in Lowndes County that if a black man was found in town and didn't get out before sunset, he wouldn't be alive to see the sun rise. So yes, you're right. I mean, Leroy Moton running along the highway, as I describe it in my book. I mean, he was terrified that he would be picked up by Klansmen or even by hostile whites, and you know, by sheer chance, he found civil rights workers who were still there, and they got him safely back to Selma.
Yeah. That night, he was concerned about being in the car with Viola, and he was concerned because the passengers were an integrated lot. Could he have stopped that? Could he have said, no, we can't do it this way?
Well, you know, actually, before Viola and Leroy Moton left on their last trip, civil rights officials warned Viola not to do it, not to drive the car, not to be out on the highway with Leroy Moton or other black passengers, that the most dangerous point really came after the march ended. There had been a very powerful federal presence in Alabama on that day. A terrific federal judge, Frank Johnson, had issued a court order protecting the marchers, and that allowed President Johnson to federalize the Alabama National Guard, to send troops, to send FBI agents, U.S. Marshals, to make sure the march came off without a hitch. But once the march ended around 5 o'clock, that protective presence ended too, and all of the National Guard and the Army and the FBI agents were leaving. So, as I say, civil rights officials told her, you know, this is the most dangerous time. Don't do this. Don't go out. But she was determined. She wanted to play an important role in this movement, and she felt that when she'd gone down there that she had not really done very much. She had worked in the first aid area and really hadn't done what she wanted to do, and was determined to drive Moton, and did.
Well, as you say at the outset of the book, this murder shocked America and galvanized the civil rights movement. Yet at the same time, her murder, Viola Liuzzo's murder, has been largely overlooked. Why?
Well, I think, I mean, there have been so many martyrs in the civil rights movement. I think historians particularly, and it's important to remember that in so many ways, the real heroes of the civil rights movement are not the white people who went down and participated in marches or joined the Freedom Riders. It was black Americans in the South who were the backbone, always the backbone of the civil rights movement in the South, and they were the ones who risked their lives and lost their lives on a daily basis. I was talking with a woman in Mississippi last week who's doing research on the civil rights movement, and she's discovered that there are thousands of unsolved murders of black people over the last 30, 40 years in Mississippi. So I think historians have perhaps overlooked her and some of the other white people who were involved, because it must be understood by, you know, students of history and by Americans that the real heroes of, I mean, Viola Liuzzo, there's no question that she was a courageous woman, and that her death did accelerate the passage of the Voting Rights Act that has been so important. But we have to remember that the real heroes of this story are the black civil rights workers.
Hmm. Do you think we'll see those stories emerging over time in the near term here?
I would hope so. You know, one of the poorest examples of this story being told is the movie Mississippi Burning that came out in the late 1980s. This is a film that has the FBI as the heroes of the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. And blacks in that film are portrayed as being passive, as essentially being sheep who are just victimized by white segregationists and ultimately are rescued by the FBI. And this is a terrible distortion of history. And when that film came out, historians attacked it strongly. But that film was very successful, and of course it's shown on television. And for young people who know nothing about the civil rights movement, they watch this film and they think, wow, the real heroes of the civil rights movement are FBI agents.
There we have
And I'm not seeing that change, frankly. Another example, Ghosts of Mississippi, that Rob Reiner made in the 1990s about the Medgar Evers story. The hero of that film is the white prosecutor who later went after Medgar Evers' killer. We don't learn anything about Medgar Evers, who was in some ways the bravest man who ever lived, the Mississippi NAACP field secretary in the early 1950s to 1963, who was the entire civil rights movement in Mississippi, who was beaten, who faced death every day and was finally assassinated. We don't know anything about him, and the film doesn't show us anything of his life. The whole focus is on the white heroes in that film.
Mm-hmm. There we have to leave it. Gary May, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Historian Gary May has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is The Informant, The FBI, The Ku Klux Klan, and the Murder of Viola Liuzzo. The book is published by Yale. It's 1:53. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade this afternoon, futures finished in the bean pit, down 16 cents in the July. November contract off 18.5. Corn futures are off about a quarter of a cent today. We'll take a look at why that happened this afternoon during the closing market report at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock, not too very far away, when we speak with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois. July wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade had a high price today of $3.37.25. A low of 3.32, settled on that low. They were off a nickel for the July. That's the harvest month for the soft red winter wheat at the Board of Trade. September futures, 3.48 on the high. The low at 3.41.5. Settlement price there, $3.42. They were down 4.5 for the day. And the December contract to 3.55.5 high. Low at 3.55.75. And or that's the settlement price at 3.55.75, down 4.75. The high was 61.5. The low was at 55.5. Once again, the settlement for the Dease wheat at 3.55.75. It was down 4.75 for the day. March contract now 3.72.5. The high, the low at 3.67.5. Settlement price at 3.68.25, down 3.75. In the May contract in the wheat pit, the high price today $3.76. The low at 3.72.5, settled on that low. They were off 2.5 at the end of the day. July futures in the corn pit now, 2.33.75 on the high. The low at $2.29.5. Settlement price at 2.30.75, down a quarter. September futures 2.42.75 high. Low at 2.38.5. Settlement price there at $2.39.75. They were down a quarter of a cent for the day. And the December contract, your harvest month, new crop Dease, 2.54 the high. The low at 2.49.5. The red December, 2.51. The settlement price unchanged on the day. March contract 2.61, the high, the low at 2.57, settled 2.58. They were up a quarter. May futures up a quarter as well, 2.64.5 the high, the low at $2.60 a bushel. And May corn for next year at 2.61.25, up a quarter of a cent. July futures for 2006, 2.65.75 the high, the low at 2.62, settled there at 2.63.5, and they were down a half for the day. From the soy complex now, July beans, or rather, July beans a 7.16 high, low at 6.96, and a settlement price at 6.96.25. They were off 16 cents today. August futures 7.20 the high, low at 6.97.5, settled at $6.98.25, down 17.25. And September futures 7.24 the high, the low at 7.01.5, settlement price at 7.02.25, off 17 cents. November beans down 18.5 today, 7.33 the high. The low at 7.08, settlement price at $7.09.5. Once again, that November contract down 18.5 at the Chicago Board of Trade. January futures 7.34, the high, the low at 7.10, settled $7.11, down 18.5 in the March contract, 7.23 the high, The low and supplement price both at $7.03 a bushel. For the March soybeans, they were down 16 cents for the 2006 contract. Bean meal July futures, 220-250, the high, the low, 215.50. Settlement price at 216.20, off $4.60. August contract down 5.10 today, 216.40, the high, the settlement, the high at 223.50, the low at 215.80, and once again the August bean meal settled at 216.40, they were down 5.10. July bean oil now, 25.57, the high, the low at 25, and the settlement price down there at 25 as well. They were off 30 for the day, and the August bean oil, 25.68, the high, the low at 25.03, settled 25.09. They were down 32. And we'll go back and catch the oats very quickly. July futures, 171.5, the high, the low at 166. Settlement price at 171, up 3 cents for the day. September futures were up a penny, 174.5. The settlement price with a high at 174.5 and a low at $1.70.5. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Prices higher today on the Merc. August feeder cattle 111.80, the high 111.05, the low, the settlement 111.65, that up 92.5. September 111.17.5, the high 110.55, the low 110.90, the settlement that up 65. October feeder cattle 109.50, the high 108.80, the low 109.45, the settlement that up 82.5. August live cattle 80.95, the high 80.35, the low 80.62.5, the settlement that up 47.5. October 84.05, the high 83.55, the low 83.87.5, the settlement that up 32.5. July lean hog 69.80, the high 68.60, the low 69.65, the settlement that up 165. August 69.10, the high 67.85, the low 68.72.5, the settlement that up 137.5. October 59.80, the high 59.25, the low 59.75, the settlement that up 65. December 56.50, the high 55.95, the low 56.30, the settlement that up 37.5. July belly 60.90, the high 59.25, the low, the settlement 60.65, that up 115. The Dow is down 86 points, the NASDAQ off 7, the S&P 500 8 lower.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, working with the American farmer, creating products from his crops, creating markets for his crops. ADM, resourceful by nature.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Gil Roy from Gilroy, California writes, "Dear Dr. Science, I often hear that we're running out of groundwater. Wouldn't it be fairly simple just to make more?"
You'd be surprised. Water grinding machinery hasn't been manufactured in this country.